And now it's gone. Are you sure it was there and then it disappeared? Maybe it was never delivered.
I had the shipping company ask the delivery guy. He confirmed that he left it. Why would he lie?
A long pause, and then Doug's voice takes on an eerily calm quality, like he's a hostage negotiator or whoever it is who talks suicidal people off ledges.
Because he was covering his ass?
He probably delivered it to the wrong house. Unlikely, but possible, I guess.
The notes are weird, he says. I'll give you that. But to think someone's running around stealing packages?
If they can leave notes, why wouldn't they steal? They're getting bolder. That's what scares me.
This is a really safe neighborhood, Kat.
I want to think so, too.
It's a really expensive neighborhood. Like I can forget that. I make sure our bills get paid on time.
What I mean is, if one of our neighbors is writing the notes, then they might be eccentric, but I doubt they're dangerous.
Another pause. Speaking of eccentric, there's that lady across the street, the one who's obsessed with parking. Did you park in her space?
No, I haven't parked in her space, and it's not Gladys.
How do you know?
She's 80 years old. Part C is heavy. It's particle board. It's like he didn't even hear me.
Gladys probably watches the street like a hawk. She doesn't have anything else going on in her life, so she's got the time to nurse grudges.
I can hear him warming to his argument.
You said yourself that the handwriting is perfect. She probably had to take penmanship classes in her day. No one under 50 even knows how to write anymore. You think you're on the geriatric mob hit list?
We might laugh about this later, but it's not later. The last note said, "Your poor little girl."
I get why you're bothered. I know you're already on edge with the whole move and trying to make a good impression on everyone.
Do not make this about me.
I'm trying to say that I understand why you'd be upset.
But you don't think I have a reason to be? I hear him sigh.
I just don't want you to work yourself up. Whoever it is, man, woman, aardvark, don't let them get to you, okay? A bully loves a reaction. We're talking about high school pranks here. Maybe it's that goth girl next door.
Maybe. Though I don't really think it's Hope. Somehow it just feels more adult than that.
We'll talk when I get home, okay? We'll figure out how to make you feel safe.
I'm going to call the police.
Wait until tonight. I'll talk to Wyatt when I get home. I'll see what he thinks we should do.
That implies that Wyatt is someone to be trusted. We have no idea if that's the case. I don't think that's a good idea.
You wanted to call the police, and Wyatt's on the force.
It just makes sense.
I ran into him the other night, and we talked for a half hour. He's a good guy.
I read somewhere that the psychological profiles of cops and criminals are extremely similar. They both think they're above the law. I don't want him repeating this to the other neighbors.
I'll tell him it's just between us.
He's a cop. He knows how to keep things quiet.
I don't answer.
Listen, he says. I'm upset, too. I don't like someone treating you like this. But you know how you can get.
How do I get, Doug? Now he doesn't answer.
Let me help, okay? He finally says. Let me talk to Wyatt.
I know how this will go. He's determined, and he'll wear me down nicely. Because he's undamaged. So his judgment is above reproach. But what's that old saying? Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean nobody's after you.
Chapter 13.
Maybe you could just put up the spice rack, I say to Doug with a weary hope. If our house is more in order, literally, everything will feel manageable again. Once the spice rack is affixed to the wall, I'll be able to at least put the spices in their proper place. That's one more box I can break down, albeit a small one, and it'll be easier to start cooking again. Cooking is a baby step toward making a house a home.
The kitchen is small and the oak cabinetry is dated, but it gets good light. Someday I'd like to add a backsplash in a bright color, something befitting Crayola. But today I'll settle for the spice rack. And then tomorrow, Doug can build the kitchen cart to house our pots and pans. 1 foot in front of the other, one box at a time. Everything's going to be fine. Sure, one person doesn't seem to want me in the AV, but I'm wanted by everyone else. I've been invited to my second girls' night out, and not just by one person. They've all texted me to make sure I'm coming. That means I'm going to be a regular at girls' night. Andy never pulled that off. And sure, part C is missing. But that could be because the driver made a mistake and then lied to cover it up, like Doug said. Or, if it was stolen, that only renders the whole note thing juvenile and harmless. Someone who steals particle board is not someone to fear. It probably is Hope and her teenage friends. It could be some goth initiation ritual, for all I know. Doug is dancing around with Sadie, and she's rewarding him with giggles. This is what I should focus on. This is real life. It's the weekend, I say. Let's make some progress on the house, and then we can go have fun. Doug does a little soft shoe. I've been cooped up all week in a cube. I need a break. I need to get out in the sunshine pronto. We'll get out, but do one thing first. I'm practically begging. Just the spice rack or the bookshelf? I'm the one who watched Sadie while you were out partying with your new friends last week. Doesn't that count for anything? I mean, I did everything for her. You wouldn't believe the size of her poop. I should be nominated for Father of the Year after cleaning that up. I know he's kidding. He's not one of those guys who's never changed a diaper, but it rankles anyway. He watches Sadie by himself for one night and changes a poopy diaper and he's Father of the Year? Please, Doug, I implore. He stops moving and cocks his head. Then we stroll Main Street. And for the rest of the day, not another word about building or installing or, heaven forbid, affixing. It's the best deal I'm going to get. A half hour later, the spice rack is up and we're headed out with Sadie in her stroller. Doug is in high spirits. I wish there was a boys' night out, he says. Maybe I should start one myself. Vic seems cool. Oliver, definitely Nolan. I wince. It's visceral. My response to that name. Doug might as well be saying Leighton. It's a good thing that Andy doesn't bring him up much. Come to think of it, open as she appears, she doesn't actually share that much personal information about her home life at all. And Wyatt, for sure, Doug says. He's awesome. Doug had been true to his word, knocking on Wyatt's door and disappearing inside for more than an hour. Yet when Doug returned home, he was unusually succinct in describing their talk. Yes, Wyatt was going to keep things confidential. No, he didn't have any idea who the writer could be. Yes, Wyatt would keep more of an eye on our house. No, there was no need to call the police.
The thing is, Doug told me, the department wouldn't do much in a case like this. There's no one to issue a restraining order against, and they're not really going to take a bunch of anonymous notes seriously.
The notes are threatening.
There's no explicit threat. You wouldn't believe how overt it has to be before the police will do anything. Wyatt told me some stories.
Seeing my face, he clams up. Then he says,
It's going to be okay. Wyatt says whoever's doing this will get tired. They'll run out of steam.
I hesitate. I want to believe that so badly. But then I remember note number 3. You thought we were done here?
Wyatt knows how these kinds of people operate, Kat. He knows common harassment patterns. And an increased police presence as soon as the new neighbors arrive won't exactly endear us to the block. He's looking out for us, Kat. He's a good person.
You're sure he's not going to tell anyone?
Positive. He said he won't even mention it to Yolanda.
If Wyatt thinks it's no big deal, if the police see far worse all the time, then I should try to accept his assessment. It suddenly strikes me that Wyatt's wife is the only one who hasn't texted me about girls' night out. Yolanda is the only one who hasn't regularly made it clear that she wants my friendship. Now, as we stroll past the park en route to Main Street, the first people I see are Wyatt and Yolanda. It's like when you've had a dream about someone and then you open your eyes and there they are. There's a sense of unreality to the whole scene. But nothing could be more ordinary. Branstone's daughter, Zoe, is playing with Yolanda's twin boys in the sandbox. Wyatt's got his feet submerged beside them. Brandon and Yolanda are sitting on the edge, chattering away like magpies. I remember now that they watch each other's kids a lot. Though right now, Wyatt's doing all the watching. Stone is on a nearby bench, scrolling on his phone. Doug pushes the stroller over to Wyatt, activates the foot brake, and then claps Wyatt on the back. Wyatt stands up and gives Doug a bear hug like they've known each other for years. Yolanda is watching our approach, her eyes slightly narrowed, before her expression melts into a smile for me. Brandon leaps up. "Long time no see," he crows. He clutches me in a hug. "Hi," I eke out. When Brandon releases me, he smacks himself on the forehead. "I've been totally meaning to bring over some hand-me-downs for the little lady, if that's all right. We spend way too much on Zoe's clothes. It'd be great to keep them on the block." "Thanks," I say with a smile. "But don't worry, we're getting by." "Of course you are. That baby of yours could be in a potato sack and she'd win first prize at the county fair." Yolanda laughs.
"You can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy."
"I hope you're wrong about that," Brandon says. The conversation between Yolanda and Brandon flows around me, a slow-moving current, and I can wade in whenever I feel like it or stand on the banks. It's comfortable, non-demanding. I find myself hoping that neither of them wrote those notes, that neither of them grabbed Part C. They're both around on weekdays, right? For reasons of scheduling, Stone's off the hook. Maybe Wyatt, too, though cops can have irregular hours.
"Hey," Doug calls over to me, "what do you think about having a housewarming party?"
I feel almost like he's testing me, making sure that I'm still prepared to open up despite everything, and in such a public forum. But that's not Doug's way. He's not underhanded like that. He loves a party, that's all. "We'll talk about it," I say.
"Uh-oh,"
Stone laughs from his bench. Other than his initial wave and greeting, I hadn't thought he was listening. "We just need to get things more in order. Our house is still a mess."
"It's adorable," Yolanda pronounces, "and so colorful."
"It's all Kat's doing,"
Doug grins at me. Then he's back talking to Wyatt, and I smile awkwardly at Yolanda and Brandon.
"I know you're not completely settled in," Brandon says, "but I bet you've at least gotten rid of all the bad juju."
Yolanda smacks him on the shoulder playfully.
"There's no bad juju."
"Niels and Ilsa?"
He raises an eyebrow.
"There's some bad juju."
"What do you mean?" I ask, my throat tightening just slightly.
"Brandon just likes to gossip."
Yolanda gives me a smile.
"You have nothing to worry about."
It seems like Wyatt kept his word and she really doesn't know about the notes.
"It's not gossip," Brandon says. "It's personal experience."
"Story for another time."
Yolanda regards him fondly. There's true affection between these two. But was there also a tiny hint of warning in her look?
"We should get going," Doug calls to me. "Our girl's getting antsy."
I'd enjoy Main Street on an ordinary day, but the phrase bad juju keeps ringing in my ears. Could Niels and Ilsa be behind the notes? They sold us the house and then regretted it? I'm tired of speculating, tired of everything all of a sudden. That morphs into irritability, which centers on Doug, perhaps unfairly. I'm trying not to be bugged that Doug put me on the spot about the party, the same as he forced me into drinks at Oliver and Gina's, which then reminds me of the bikes. I'm also trying to forget that Dad of the Year comment and how Doug makes me twist his arm to get anything done in the house. But he's working hard these days, I know. I don't want to resent him, and I do want us to spend more time strolling around the neighborhood, doing what normal people do. I want to get to know the village. I like gelato as much as the next person. I find myself trailing Doug, who's using Sadie like a prop, since everywhere we go, she attracts attention. I stand by, doing my best to smile while he makes small talk, seemingly oblivious to my mood. He's probably just chalking it up to introversion, thinking I should push myself out of my comfort zone. It's not like he heard the bad juju remark, after all. In the bike shop, Doug and the proprietor start gabbing away. He has me trying on helmets. He even picks one out for Sadie. Then there are bike locks and rainproof covers that are perfectly sized, which also means perfectly expensive. "Couldn't we just buy this stuff at Target?" I ask him when the owner steps away.
"You have to support local businesses," he says with a cheerful smile.
I bounce Sadie up and down in my arms, smiling stiffly, while he talks to shopkeepers and customers alike. I watch him in his element. He doesn't seem to notice or care how I'm feeling. I should probably tell him outright, but isn't he the one who claimed, on our second date, that his skill was reading people and giving them what they want? That skill seems to have abandoned him when it comes to his own wife. Stop it, Cat. I don't want to be that wife who stands by silently, awash in resentment. I want to appreciate him for what he's good at, like talking to people, and accept what he's not, which is putting together furniture in a timely manner. Besides, this isn't really about Doug. This is about the notes, Part C, and bad juju. It's my fear of escalation, of what might be coming next. It's about the shame I feel over a past that I'm afraid is catching up to me right now, that a neighbor somehow knows what I haven't even told my own husband. It's about all that I need to keep boxed up and buried on a block full of people who claim they can see through me. "Can we just get a gelato and go home?" I say.
"Sure. The only other thing we have to do is stop by Tennyson's boutique."
"I'm really tired, Doug." He squints in evaluation. Finally, he says,
"Okay, a gelato and then home."
I give him a big hug and smack a kiss on his cheek, and he laughs. I knew it would be okay if I just told him what I want and how I feel. But I can't share it all. For him to know the whole of me would change everything. He'd never look at me the same again, and I've always loved how he looks at me. He knows about my mother's depression. He knows she could barely function, let alone attend to me emotionally. He knows about the poverty and the neglect. There's the father I never knew and the mother who didn't give me enough love, but that's it. No more. Leighton and Ellen, that's another level. As it is, Doug thinks that the reason I'm not crazy about his parents is because of my childhood. Imagine how he would consider my thoughts and behaviors, especially ones he didn't like, if he knew the rest. Imagine how easily I could be dismissed. It's okay if Doug pities me just a little, but if he knew everything, he'd be disgusted. And I couldn't live with that. Chapter 14. Andy's driving again, though I notice she's dressed a lot more conservatively this time. Actually, she's dressed like I was the first night, in jeans and a cute top. I wind her up and let her go. I ask questions about her favorite restaurants in the AV, the best sangria, a great manicure, a skilled hairstylist. I'm doing a Doug trick. Make her feel like a valued authority. But unlike him, I'm not paying attention to her recommendations. I'm just killing time. Much as I like Andy, the last thing I need is to be around someone who can read me. I want to be in my bed, shades drawn, covers pulled up to my chin, watching a Netflix marathon. I feel like this night is destined to end badly, but I didn't know how to get out of it. Declining the second invitation seemed like terrible form. There might not be a third.
You seem sort of quiet,
Andy says as we're pulling into a parking space across from Hound.
Is everything okay?
I could tell her about the notes. Then she'd forgive my strange mood, and it would cement our friendship.
Just tired, I say.
Hound is still cramped, serpentine, and dark, but this time, Andy and I are the last to arrive. June, Yolanda, Raquel, Tennyson, and Gina are assembled around the conjoined table with shots lined up for all of us, including me. It's an offer that's hard to refuse in my current fried state. My nerves are crying out for a salve.
You made it!
Gina seems truly happy to see me. She's in a shapeless t-shirt, her mushroom hair anchored by a headband.
Hey there!
June looks like she's in good spirits, too. Much more coiffed than I've seen her before. Her auburn hair is usually in a ponytail, but tonight she's styled it into spiral curls, and she's in full makeup. I wouldn't have thought it before, but she can be nearly as attractive as Tennyson and Yolanda.
Tequila,
Tennyson says by way of greeting, pointing at the shot glass intended for me.
We're starting with a classic tonight.
It's a nice bed for the golden revolver,
Raquel adds. Tennyson laughs.
It's not called a golden revolver.
Whatever.
Raquel is looking unusually sexy tonight in a low-cut shirt and push-up bra. Something else is different. It takes me a second, and then I realize she's not wearing her glasses. She and June got the same memo. Andy and I missed it.
Down the hatch, June says.
She lifts her glass in my direction as if to toast.
Salud,
Yolanda says.
Mazel tov, from Andy.
I don't know if it's the fact that each woman is tossing her drink back in turn and I'm just susceptible to peer pressure, or if it's that earlier I noticed Sadie has way more than enough milk and one pump and dump wouldn't impact her at all. It could be nerves, or that the shot glass is just sitting there and I hate to waste anything. It could be a desire for obliteration. Whatever the reasons, it's salud and down the hatch and mazel tov for me, too. The other women congratulate me like I've done something brave.
Sometimes you just need to look after yourself,
Tennyson says approvingly, as if this is a version of treating myself to a massage. From there, it doesn't seem like much of a leap to my first silk purse. Both go to my head quickly, and I see, with perfect clarity, why alcohol is essential in life. All of a sudden, I'm in the moment and forgetting all the stresses of the past couple of weeks. My inner censor has been muted. I feel verbally limber and loose enough to banter with the best of them. I'm even feeling, dare I say, a little bit sexy. If I had a button to undo, I would. If I get the next round, I might even flirt with the bartender. Then Gina says,
Let's get down to business.
Tennyson does a mock spit take.
Gina, seriously?
The guest of honor is already liquored up, Gina answers. I look around, wondering who she's talking about. Then I realize they're all looking at me. Gina leans toward me just slightly, her mushroom hair especially voluminous tonight, her eyes intent on mine. It occurs to me that Tennyson could just be a figurehead, and Gina might be the true power. She's certainly coming off like the ringleader tonight.
Let me ask you something crucial. Why are you monogamous?
Now I want to do a spit take. What? What do you mean? I stammer.
You've probably never even thought about it before, right? You're monogamous because that's what marriage is. Because you think it's the only way to do it.
Listen, Tennyson drawls. Marriage is an evolving institution. I mean, women used to be property.
Now men and women make each other property, Raquel says, controlling each other. You know, you love me because you won't have sex with anyone else, even though it's totally normal to want to.
Have you read Esther Perel? Gina asks.
I shake my head. I wish I hadn't had that silk purse. It's hard to keep up with this conversation.
Esther Perel talks about how sexual desire is activated by novelty, while traditional marriage says that denying yourself any other partners is a prerequisite. That's a paradox, a double bind.
No wonder there are so many affairs.
Tennyson raises her hand.
I mean, guilty.
Vic and I decided that we were going to do it differently this time around. No one owns anybody, and we can accept ourselves and each other as sexual beings. That's why we're so happy.
Why are you so happy? I ask stupidly. I'm not quite following.
Here's the deal, Tennyson says. Normally, you're monogamous because you think the only other options are eternal dating or being in a relationship and cheating.
Or you're monogamous because you only want to be with your husband, I say, and he only wants to be with you.
But I already outed myself at the last girls' night. They know I don't exactly want to be with Doug. I want to be with Doug. That's a big difference. A part of me has always known, deep down, that the AV was too good to be true. I've been waiting for the bottom to drop out. Tennyson is giving me a slightly dubious look, a smile playing at her lips. Can every one of them really see through me? This is a nightmare.
If that's the case, if you and Doug only want to be with each other, then you opt out.
Opt out of what? I say.
The spreadsheet.
I look at Andy and I see that she knows exactly what the spreadsheet is. Of course she does. I feel blindsided by my new friend. She couldn't have given me some sort of heads up. I would have prepared something to say. Or at the very least, I wouldn't have had a shot plus a silk purse after a year of abstinence.
The spreadsheet is where everyone states their preferences, Andy tells me quietly. There are couples who are primarily monogamous, with an occasional hall pass, and some who have ongoing relationships outside of their marriages.
Each couple comes up with their own rules, Yolanda says. It might be that same sex is okay, but opposite isn't. Or they can only be with a third party together. You can only be with someone if I am. We get to veto each other's potential partners. No sex in our house or in our bed. No sleepovers. Don't ask, don't tell.
I see her really warming to this. Where Yolanda is concerned, the more rules, the better.
Some couples opt in for a while and then opt out, Andy says. And then some, June says, her eyes dancing, opt back in.
Is June involved in this? She's not even part of a couple. She just gets to sample everyone's husbands without any complications at all? It doesn't seem quite fair.
The spreadsheet is really dynamic.
Tennyson polishes off the rest of her drink.
Each couple has to decide together what they really want. It leads to all kinds of really intimate, revealing conversations. You'll know Doug better than you ever imagined you could just by talking about all this stuff, about your truest desires.
My stomach plummets just as Tennyson stands up.
Anyone want another?
Raquel tosses hers back and then rattles the ice in her now empty glass. Everyone else, including me, says they're okay. A hush falls over the table once she's gone.
I don't really know what to say, I tell them.
You're not expected to answer tonight, Raquel says. It's a lot to think about. Obviously, you need to talk to Doug.
He'll dismiss it out of hand, I'm sure. We'll dismiss it together.
People are so jealous and paranoid because they're afraid to lose, Gina says. Think how liberating it would be to set your marriage free.
Raquel reads my expression because she says,
No, really. You go off and you're with someone else and you get that euphoria, right? You get the initial infatuation. Then you go home in a great mood and everything's lustier. But we all have our eyes open. We all know exactly what that is, and we don't fool ourselves into thinking the grass is greener on the other side. In the end, we're all going home to our husbands and wives. There are no affairs here. It's all out in the open.
That's the key, Yolanda says.
We're open here, and there are no divorces. Families stay together.
I glance at Tennyson. She's on her second marriage, right? But maybe her first marriage didn't have the spreadsheet.
Families are stronger because they're headed by two people who know they're not just stuck with each other, you know?
Raquel's eyes are bright, even in the dim.
We all want to go home to our husbands.
She really means what she's saying, but a part of me just can't imagine wanting to go home to someone who looks at me the way Bart was looking at her that day at the block party. Like he wanted to rip her limb from limb. Or was that just the intensity of his sexual desire? Because he'd just been with, say, Tennyson, and now he was hot for Raquel. It doesn't compute, and yet these are smart women. Vital, interesting women. And they're telling me that this works. They want me to be a part of their community. I mean, really a part of their community. I'd wondered if I'd be accepted. Now it's much more than that. I'm actually desired. Or Doug is.
This probably sounds kind of insane, right? June says. Every one of us thought so, once upon a time, but it actually works.
If it works so well, what happened to her husband?
We've never asked someone to join this fast, Raquel says. Usually it takes a while of getting to know someone. But with you, it was unanimous after the last girls' night. We were like, why wait?
I'm slightly flattered. Warped as this whole scenario is.
There's something about you, Yolanda says. We all felt it. It's like we knew we could trust you. Don't take this the wrong way.
Raquel goes to push her glasses up her nose and then realizes she's not wearing them.
But you've got this kind of awkwardness, like you're wrestling with yourself. You're all earnest and hopeful, but it's like you know better than that. You don't want to get crushed. I don't know. We just all really responded to that and wanted you around.
Because it's not just about sex, Gina says. Then she laughs self-deprecatingly. I didn't know she had self-deprecation in her. I mean, obviously, with me, it's not about sex. We're really good friends. We lean on each other. We can share anything. It seems like Gina has been doing the hardest sell. Maybe she's the mastermind behind the spreadsheet. Her marriage needed an arrangement, and she's the definition of an overachiever. She found Oliver a neighborhood full of women to do what she doesn't want to. Tennyson returns with two drinks in her hands and plants one in front of Raquel. Then, feeling no need to catch up on the conversation, she says, "Affairs are rampant. It's not sleeping with other people that kills marriages. It's the secrecy. Secret fantasies and longings, self-denial, and eventually, betrayal. It doesn't need to be that way."
It's an experiment, Andy says. You can try it, and if you don't like it, you just forget all about it.
I study her, trying to gauge what she has and hasn't done, and whether what's done can really be undone. If Doug has sex with one of these women, I'll always know that. If I have sex with one of their men, I'd always know that, and so would they. Is that part of the allure? How incestuous it all is? That they're all bonded by intrigue and drama?
You have a favorite meal, right?
Gina looks at me, and I nod. You don't want to eat it every day for the rest of your life. You want to switch it up. Your taste buds want a different experience, and everyone gets that. Well, sexual appetites are the same way. Why do we accept our appetites around food, but not sex? No one insists on gastronomic monogamy. On gastronomy. She and the others laugh.
Let's go around the table, June says, and everyone can say the biggest advantage to the spreadsheet.
You don't have to stifle your true nature, Tennyson says immediately. I want a life partner, but I still like variety. Vic is great in bed, but he can't be every man, you know?
You don't have to wonder if the grass is greener, Andy says.
Does she mean that she was with someone else and it made her realize her own grass was just fine? That she and Nolan tried and then decided to opt out? I'm assuming she's not part of the spreadsheet now, or she would be a girls' night regular.
Well, you know my grass isn't greener, Raquel quips, and everyone laughs.
I assume she means her actual brown grass and not Bart.
It's a fair prevention, Yolanda says quietly. He'll have his experiences, but he'll never leave.
You have someone else to do the dirty work, Gina says. You know, to have the sex you don't feel like having. It takes the pressure off.
Sometimes you're more sexually compatible with someone other than your husband, June says.
It's always good to get some new inspiration, Raquel says.
It occurs to me how incredibly confident they all are, with the exception of maybe Yolanda. Are they that way because of, what should I call it, swinging, swapping, orgies, polyamory? Gina says,
this isn't all about sex.
It's not even primarily about sex. It's about freedom and openness. It's about accepting one another's choices and accepting yourself. I wasn't always so comfortable being asexual. I used to feel like I had to pretend, but now I can just be who I am. It's a legitimate choice to choose not to have sex. And since Oliver can meet his needs elsewhere, I know my value to him is about much more than sex. It's a true partnership. Society tells women they have to be sexy and sexual. Fuck that. It's freeing not to want sex. I feel so in control.
And Oliver is really okay with that?
I'm thinking it, but Andy asks it. Like an act of ventriloquism. Gina nods.
He likes clarity in all things. This way, he knows exactly what he's getting and when. He knows the bottom line. It's like all the best business deals. It's clean and everyone profits.
What do you even call this kind of arrangement, I say?
Openness.
Tennyson smiles.
Neighbors with benefits,
Yolanda adds. Don't you get jealous? I ask, and they all laugh. Jealousy is clearly well-covered territory.
Of course, Raquel says. We help each other through it. We've all been there.
Jealousy is human nature. Tennyson finishes another drink ahead of the rest of us. But I don't want to control my jealousy by chaining up my husband and keeping him in a cage.
Unless that's what he's into, Raquel says.
More laughter.
This isn't an arrangement that just benefits men, Kat. In my experience, it benefits women more. Men have always known who they are and what they want. They're encouraged to from childhood. But women? We're supposed to make everyone else happy.
I feel myself flush. She can't know. And yet...
So we have a lot to figure out about what we really want. It's more complicated for us. And society is more judgmental. We're prudes, or we're whores, or we're just old married ladies. But think about this. If no one had to know, if you could shed your inhibitions just for a day or a week, what would you want to do most? What would you want to try?
I realize it's not just rhetorical. She's actually waiting on an answer. Andy comes to my rescue.
Whatever it is, you can try it with Doug. Truly, Raquel says, my communication and my relationship with Bart have never been better, and my self-image has never been higher.
We accept you even if you don't want to be part of this, June says. It's not mandatory.
It's a perk.
Just think about it and talk to Doug.
Tennyson finishes her drink.
If you guys opt out, we totally respect that. But consider it first, okay? And ask us any questions you have.
Everyone says no at first, and then we get worn down.
Raquel smiles.
Well, it's not exactly like that, but at first, everyone is bound by convention. It just seems so abnormal, you know? And so terrifying. But then you think on it some more, and you look around, and it becomes a version of normal.
Pleasure is normal, June says.
Attraction to people other than your spouse is normal, Tennyson says. And embracing that while still loving your spouse can be normal too.
I think I was the most resistant to the idea, June says. I held out for more than a year, and meanwhile, my marriage was going down the toilet. I'm seeing all these other people indulging happily, and they're staying married happily. They're not letting society tell them what to do. But I was, and my husband was, and we were miserable.
Don't be afraid, Kat, Tennyson says. Fear is the real killer in life, you know?
You've just got to know you're beautiful, Kat, and worth coming home to, Raquel says.
We all are,
Yolanda says. It seems eerie and cult-like, but also so seductive. A siren song. They're telling me I'll want to resist, but I won't be able to, and neither will Doug.
There's a 50% divorce rate, right? June says.
But not on our block.
On our block, I'm the only one.
We're all in this together, Tennyson says. Think of us like a big support group.
Then they get down to brass tacks. Gina says,
The people at this table aren't the only ones participating, but we're the organizers. The welcome wagon, so to speak. We control the spreadsheet. We know who's opted in and who's opted out, who's currently looking and available, what everyone is looking for, and the rules for each particular couple.
If you're into someone but they're not available right now, I'll make a note, Tennyson says. Then I'll let you know when they're back up for grabs.
It's like an out-of-stock item on the internet. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. But no one seems to think so except me. They all seem so sane and so happy. And they obviously like each other. I saw that at the block party. This is the happiest group of people I've ever encountered. The truth is, I've never been a particularly happy person. I've tried to be, mightily, but with my background, it doesn't come easily.
It's all about informed consent, Tennyson tells me. You and Doug need to know this exists, and then you can decide whether you consent as a couple. You're either opting in as a couple or out as a couple.
If one of you is participating and the other isn't, the non-participant has to consent as well.
This is, naturally, from Gina.
It's a marital decision.
Those are the block rules. Tennyson is trying to get the last tiny droplets of alcohol out of her glass. But you need to develop your own rules, too, as a couple. And whatever you decide, you follow religiously. The biggest problems arise when a couple starts to break their own rules. That's a betrayal of trust and a violation. That's an affair, basically.
Why are we talking about such heavy stuff? Raquel says. You don't start there. You start by looking around and seeing who catches your eye.
Tennyson runs her finger lightly around the rim of her glass. You flirt, and then you fantasize. You let your mind wander. It's amazing what's possible. Who's possible?
They've clearly misjudged their audience. I do everything I can to keep my mind under control.
Then we adjourn. The business is over, and it's time to have fun. There's general talk and laughter, but I'm too preoccupied with what I've heard to join in.
I'll get the next round, I say, casting a quick glance at Andy, hoping she can read me as well as she claimed she could. I'll help you carry them, she says. As we dodge people, I'm lightheaded from the alcohol and the pitch I'm trying to digest. We belly up to the bar, and I hiss, What the fuck was that? She laughs, and I can see the tension she's releasing. I figured this was coming at some point. I just never thought it would be this soon. Did you think about telling me? I felt like it wasn't my secret to tell, even though it's kind of an open secret.
You and Nolan have opted out? I ask, holding my breath for the answer and exhaling at her nod.
They've refined their presentation since I first heard it. But when Gina said they were going to get to business, I knew what was coming. The bartender notices us and starts to walk over.
I wave a hand to tell him he can take other people first, no rush here. I'm definitely going to say no. It's just a question of timing.
Don't you want to talk to Doug first?
I'm not sure I need to. If one of us is opting out, we both are. That's how it works, right?
You just might want to give it a little time. You've had a lot to drink, and it's all sorts of overwhelming at first.
Whose side is she on? Didn't she just tell me she opted out?
You need to do what's right for you. And I'll be here as a sounding board. Someone neutral. Because all the women are great, they really are, but they have an agenda.
She must see the alarm in my face because she adds,
not a scary agenda or anything. I mean, they really will respect if you opt out, but they're obviously hoping you'll opt in.
Does the person who's writing the notes want me to opt in or out?
The arrangement thrives on new blood, that's all, Andy says. When someone new enters the mix, it shakes up the dynamics. There's all this interest and rivalries. Block parties feel a little more exciting. It spices things up.
Again, she catches my expression.
In a harmless way, of course. They really are all good people. They truly are close, and they do take care of each other through any drama.
I don't think I need any drama.
A little drama can be fun, she smiles.
Then she grows more serious.
I'm here for you, Kat. Opt in or out. It makes no difference to me.
I can't believe they're hitting me with this the second time we hang out.
Well, someone obviously took a quick liking to you and Doug.
Of course. Doug. The women find me trustworthy, and what they want is fresh meat. They want Doug. At the first girls' night, they were feeling me out, talking about their sex lives to bait me, to see if Doug is available. Stupid me. I basically told them he was, seeing as I have no physical desire for my imminently desirable husband. Some part of me must have known. That's why I saw their faces when Doug and I were having sex. I knew they were competition then. Community of women, my ass. The spreadsheet needs fresh meat. I feel my face heating up. I signal the bartender.
So, you ready for a little dirt? Andy asks. Tell me.
She says that Oliver has been with men and women. I knew it. Vic and Raquel were hot and heavy for a little while, and there were some threesomes with Tennyson. Bart's always had a thing for Yolanda, but she turned him down. It's a big secret who Yolanda has been with, but everyone knows that she and Wyatt have the most restrictions.
Did you opt out from the beginning? I ask. Or did you try it for a while?
For a very short while. She's clearly reticent to talk about her and Nolan, and I'm good with that. I don't like thinking about Nolan in any sort of sexual context.
I can't imagine sharing Doug. There are some open marriages that really work. Vic and Tennyson are incredibly happy and stable, but what I can say is, don't do it to fix a broken marriage.
Doug and I aren't broken.
I didn't think you were. You guys seem great.
The operative word is seem, and it hangs there between us.
I'm just saying, you need to be rock solid to introduce something like this.
After the first girls' night, I was so hopeful. I thought maybe I'd found a group of women who truly liked me, who would accept me, and now I'm outside the circle already. Not that I want to be inside, not anymore, knowing all the strings that are attached and the price I'd have to pay. So I hadn't just imagined that sex was in the air at the block party. They've set it up so that within every interaction there's always possibility. It creates an energy that permeates everything. They have what I want. Not the sex, but the confidence. Comfort in their own skins. Freedom. Nothing could be more seductive than that. Everyone opts out at first. Then they get worn down. The rest of the night is a blur. I feel depressed, and then angry at how it's all played out. How they invited me here and gave me their spiel. But maybe I did it to myself. I removed myself from the equation.
I can't be a part of their sexual round robin. I'm staring down into my fourth empty silk purse when this incredibly powerful force comes over me. Suddenly, I feel happy. So ridiculously happy. And so tactile. These are my neighbors, and I feel love for all of them. I talk and flirt and dance with everyone, men and women. The whole floor twines together as if it's one organism with 100 limbs, and it's amazing to feel this type of connection. Sensuality without sex. It's beautiful and harmless. Tonight, I'm just having good, clean fun. Tomorrow, I'll opt out. Then the first thing that changes is the smell. Someone's perfume has become rancid. I look into the crowd by the bar, all dark and menacing figures, and I could swear I see Leighton. He's not in prison. He's right over there. He begins to turn, and I want to run, but I'm frozen in place. My muscles will not obey my command. Terror sets in, while all around me, my neighbors are oblivious. Except for Andy. Thank God for Andy. I need the bathroom, I tell her. I can't get there without her, and somehow she figures that out. Or maybe I tell her. I can't be sure of what's being thought and what's being said. And she gets me there, my arm around her neck. The bathroom is gray, filthy, and windowless. Like what I'd imagine in a prison. The smell is abominable. It's bleach and feces and, perhaps more disturbingly, cotton candy and popcorn, like a county fair run by Satan. There are cockroaches. There are rats. I try again not to scream. Fortunately, Andy is a good friend and waits outside the stall. She won't let anyone hurt me. "Are you okay?" she asks. "Are you crying?" That's the last thing I remember.
Session 57. He wasn't only a teacher. He was a pillar of the community. He was on all these different boards, had his hand in everything. A model family. One son, one daughter, a stay-at-home mother. As a teacher, he was one of the most well-loved. He'd won awards from the district. Parents wanted their kids in his class. But what was he really like, behind closed doors? I've already told you that. You haven't told me much. But tell me more about you. I was kind of nerdy. I always got good grades. I had a best friend I really loved, but no other friends. I tried to be a good girl.
What was your relationship with him like?
I tried to please him. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. At the trial, the district attorneys painted this picture of someone who was calculated and diabolical, always scheming, choosing kids whose parents didn't give a rat's ass about them, kids who weren't likely to speak up, kids who weren't popular, who didn't have a lot of friends.
That sounds like you.
No comment.
What was the trial like for you?
I think we should just stop now.
Okay.
That's it? Just okay?
I told you that you're in control here.
But you still think I'm in denial.
I shouldn't have said that.
You mean you're admitting you made a mistake?
Of course. I make mistakes all the time. Sometimes I think I see an opening and I charge in, and then realize I should have taken it slower.
I've made a lot of mistakes.
I think you confuse your mistakes with his. You're still protecting him. But he should have been the one protecting you. He was in a position of authority.
You don't really understand the situation.
Help me understand.
You said I could pump the brakes whenever I want. Well, I'm pumping them.
Chapter 15. I'm fumbling, flailing, and emitting strangled cries. I'm harpooned here in the dark, suffocating. I've been swallowed. I'm in the belly of a whale, Like that book I should have read in high school. I scream. I don't know if anyone can hear me, but I have to try. I want to live. Sadie, I have to get back to her. I need to live for her. I hear heavy footsteps. Someone running. To save me or to hurt me, I don't know. I should have stayed quiet. Maybe they didn't even know I was here, whoever they are, wherever here is. Then, I'm free. My bindings are lifted and the room is flooded with light. It's my bathroom, with the gray-blue tiles, like I'm being tossed on stormy seas. I'm breathing heavily, and I realize that I'd been under a blanket made by my mother-in-law, the kind of loose-knit pattern that seems like a net. I'd never actually been trapped, but sometimes the illusion is enough. It's like how people can drown in water a foot deep.
"You scared the shit out of me," Doug says accusingly.
He's breathing heavily, too, though I don't know why. It's a tiny house. Maybe we really do need to start riding our bikes. We're in terrible shape. Well, I am, currently. My head is pounding. My stomach is roiling. I have to close my eyes against the fluorescent light.
"Sorry," I tell Doug. "First time drinking in a year. Regrets."
"Yeah."
His tone is bitter.
"I bet."
I try to remember what I could have done to make him mad. Even at the height of my partying days, I never felt like this. This sick, with a cratered memory. I remember the spreadsheet, though. There's no way I could forget that.
"You were throwing up a lot,"
Doug says, disapproving.
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't have drunk that much."
"Andy had to knock on the door and wake me up at 1 a.m. She needed me to come out and carry you out of her car, caveman style. You were completely out, like unconscious but mumbling."
My chest tightens.
"What was I mumbling?"
"I couldn't make it out. Neither could Andy.
She said that it had taken four of the women to get you into her car." I throw the blanket over my head.
"I am so mortified."
"Andy tried to make excuses for you. She said those drinks were hardcore. She only had one herself."
So Andy had stayed sober. Great. She'd remember everything. Doug squats down beside me.
"Andy really likes you. She said she knows you're going to be great friends."
His tone is scathing, like there are air quotes around great friends. I'm keeping the blanket over my head. I don't want to see him right now. Don't want to see his disgust.
"Did you guys talk long?" I ask him.
"She came in for a drink."
They used to call those late-night drinks nightcaps. It seems a little weird that Andy was having a nightcap with Doug while I was somewhere passed out. But Andy's not someone I need to worry about. She opted out. I definitely remember that. He says, defensively,
"I needed to stay up for a while to make sure you were okay. I couldn't let you choke on your own vomit, could I? She offered to keep me company."
"I should have had one drink at most. I probably shouldn't have even had that."
My breasts are heavy and leaking, or have already leaked. The front of my shirt is damp. I never did the pump and dump. I need to do it now. I throw off the blanket and stagger to my feet. I'm not drunk, not in my brain, but in my body. I'm still in last night's clothes, so my phone is in the front pocket of my jeans. I hear an incoming text, and I see that it's one of many from Andy, including one that reads, "I've never seen anyone that drunk." As if my face could grow any hotter. "Thanks for getting me home last night," I text back. "I'm so sorry about that. Did I do or say anything I want to forget?" "No, you were a blast. Don't worry at all. What are friends for?" Then, quick on the heels of that one, she writes, "The whole point of girls' night is to let your hair down. You partied like a rock star." No, the whole point of girls' night is to get fresh meat for the spreadsheet. Well, I won't be a regular, not once I tell them I'm opting out, but I'll still have Andy. I hate not knowing exactly what happened last night.
It's part of why I stopped drinking entirely for a period in my 20s. I don't want to have to ask other people what I did. I haven't had this experience since I started seeing Dr. Morrison. Back then, I was trying to forget. Now, my life is entirely different.